I realized I kind of like accidentally stumbled into methods that some of these like hedge funds are doing really quietly. I'm just like putting them out there right now for Bitcoiners. It seems like they recognize that the Sailor strategy is clearly a better strategy than what they've been embarking on. They chose to spend their time in that manner by directly leeching the wealth out of the exact people who they claim to have as customers. I'm a fundamentally different person for having discovered Bitcoin. I'm way more optimistic and constructive, motivated, just like so many different things. It's just impossible to convey all the things that you know about Bitcoin to other people. These newer people that are just coming into the Bitcoin market are disproportionately afraid. I have so much anger towards the way the system currently works and want that to change. I just want to hang the political class and all these things. Like, I have a part of myself that feels that way too.
I want to burn this thing down. What rises from the ashes will be so much better and more glorious and more fair and more true and more honest. Michael Sullivan, author of Blood of the Bourgeoisie, that I still, every time I try to type out bourgeoisie, I don't know, I tend to be pretty good at the spelling, but for some reason that word just messes with me. How many, are you now the world-leading expert at spelling bourgeoisie on the first attempt?
My fingers just naturally do it. I can't do it right anymore. The amount of times I've had to type this thing out. My favorite thing is seeing how people pronounce it too. I never like to shame them for it because there's technically a bunch of different ways. But yeah, I at the conference, I was just like walking up to people and be like, yeah, I'm that guy that wrote that weird named book. And people were like, oh yeah, I know what you're talking about.
What's the weirdest way you've heard bourgeoisie pronounced?
The best one is Borghese.
Mm. Yeah. Okay. That's kind of like, it's like, hey, y'all read that book, Blood of the Borghese? Like that's what's coming to mind right there. But yeah, no shame pronouncing things however you want. You can feel free to use the dirty words of Marx and pronounce them however you feel like. He's just making things up anyway too. Man, but stoked to have you on here. We got a few things to talk about today. Number one, you are the author of a incredible book, a piece of Bitcoin thriller that is kind of what you and I talked about. I narrated the audiobook, and thank you for that honor. It was a fun audiobook to narrate. And it's very much a sly roundabout way of, I think, orange-pilling people and getting them to learn about Bitcoin through the medium of fiction, which is really powerful, and I think something we need more of. I want to talk about that. People should go check out Blood of the Bourgeoisie, if you can spell it, by Michael Sullivan. If you just type Michael Sullivan, Blood of the should populate, if you can't spell bourgeoisie or if you struggle like I do. But then you've also been doing this really interesting sentiment analysis stuff that's kind of, you've gotten a decent amount of, like, I would say acclaim or feedback on this now. Like, it's kind of making it out into the larger space. Want to talk about that too. And maybe that's a good place to start. And just for people to know, you're a man of many interests. You're obviously an author of you've written multiple books now. You're also you're a developer, computer programmer, engineer. I don't know what, moniker you prefer for that. And then you do a lot of grappling, a lot of BJJ and whatnot too. You do a lot of things. You're a dad as well. Yep. Anything else I'm missing there in the world of Michael Sullivan?
Oh, probably chess enthusiast. I like music a lot too. I basically just have like super high functioning ADHD where I like to do a million different things all at the same time. And it kind of fills me up with energy jumping around to different things.
Yeah. It's something I notice is a common thread amongst many of us Bitcoiners. But okay, let's start out. We'll talk about Blood of the Bourgeoisie a little bit again. People should go check out that book. Check out the audiobook too if you want to hear it in my seemingly dulcet tones. But let's start on the sentiment analysis piece because I think this is really interesting. We were talking just off camera that this, in my mind, the way I think about this is like you are quantifying the vibes. Mm-hmm. You're putting numbers. You're giving significance to the general vibes of, and you're looking at this individually, right? But maybe let's take a step back. What is this sentiment analysis that you are doing right now? And how did you actually, like, what prompted you to start doing this?
Yeah, this has been a weird evolution for me. I, like, been a writer for a long time, been an engineer, been really obsessed with language. I, like, in writing stories and things, you can really use like language as a tool to convey a lot about characters. You can insert words that kind of like indicate how a person's thoughts and beliefs are changing over time. And the longer I've been in the Bitcoin space, the more I've recognized this thing happens out there too. Like the average mood of Bitcoiners is very different at peaks compared to at bottoms. And the amount of time people are arguing about things or at each other's throats during price dips is pretty high. I think people mostly like intuitively recognize this and have experienced it.
but I kind of wanted to like see if I could quantify it anyway. And originally it was just like this curiosity for me. I like to write novels because I like to pursue a thread and think about something really deeply. And I wanted to analyze my own data on posts that I've done in the past and just see if there was like any interesting stuff there. Like, did I say anything stupid at different times? Was I overly optimistic or annoyed at different bottoms and things? And the answer is yes. I've said a lot of dumb shit over the years. That was a emphatic yes. But what was really interesting is that I actually was able to really tightly correlate like moods that I'd had over time and stuff with like Bitcoin price enthusiastic uptrends. I was like, wow, this is really interesting. And I wanted to keep pursuing it. So I started doing it for other accounts too. Like Michael Saylor was the next one, just doing large ones, and found surprising dynamics where he like would really get optimistic before there was news out there around MicroStrategy or something like that, where he wouldn't convey anything. He'd have to be really close to chess with the words that he chose. But like sometimes the mood leaks into your language in interesting ways. And I really wanted to see if I could like with like engineering tools and data analysis tools and AI evaluate these? And the answer was yes. So I've been really deep into that and coming at it through a more individualized lens, which is maybe one of the more unique things about it. As you mentioned, a lot of the sentiment stuff that's out there right now is really trash because it'll be like, let's just aggregate everything that was said on Reddit or Twitter today and look at what the mood is. And that's garbage because there's all these bot accounts or people that'll say things that are inflammatory intentionally to get traction or interest. So I took it through the total opposite lens where I'm like, let's look at individuals that I think are like legit Bitcoiners. So I know personally, I know they're real. I know they're like relatively high signal. They've been around longer. They've been around shorter, various things, and look at them on a more individualized basis. And then like look at different cohorts of them. That's just super high level, but it's been like this crazy thing where I've kind of started pulling on this thread and it's just compounded and turned into this wildly fascinating project that I've been just completely obsessed with.
Amazing. Couple questions. When you talk about these other sentiment analysis tools, are you talking about like fear and greed index, things like that? Are there other ones that you look at where you say, because the fear and greed's like that's the one at least I know and probably most people know as like, yep, you know, that's the sentiment index, right? Are there other ones or is that kind of the primary one that you look at with regard to Bitcoin?
There's so much of this. One thing that's the main one I was referring to. But one thing I realized as I got deeper into this is that like, hedge funds behind the scenes have these tools all the time and are scraping all these things and have their own sentiment analyses and numbers that they're using in this kind of stuff. And I realized I kind of like accidentally stumbled into methods that some of these like hedge funds are doing really quietly. And I'm just like putting them out there right now for Bitcoiners currently. But there's a lot of different ways to measure sentiment. Like sentiment's a super loaded word. In the fact that like we all like, we'll reference like current Bitcoin sentiment, but there is so much more granularity to that than I originally even thought when I started investigating this. And a phrase I've kept using to describe it is kind of like the analogy of like, this is water. Like you're swimming in this thing all the time. And you're kind of blind to it. Like everything and every opinion that you have kind of exists within this broader like sentiment that exists out there. Every time you engage with a Bitcoin, every time you listen to a podcast, every time you read something on Twitter, it's through the lens of like what broader people are feeling at the time. And people do brilliant jobs. Like James Check is just fantastic. Like I've learned so much from him with the on-chain analysis and the like tracking of actual UTXOs. And like, I was so inspired by that. But because of my background and being so interested in language, I wanted to see if I could do similar things, but look at the actual words and narratives people were using over time and see how beliefs evolved. So that was kind of like one of the high level ways I started doing that. And it actually ended up being pretty fruitful.
I find this super, super interesting. And I want to know, as you said, you started analyzing yourself and you were looking for other kind of key people that, you know, you were, you know, I guess, following already, people that are, you know, high signal in the Bitcoin arena. But so this is not necessarily aggregation of a bunch of people. This is more individualized, or do you also then aggregate the individualized analyses as well?
Yeah, so this is where it got really interesting. I originally just started doing it on a few people, like ones that I theorized might be high signal or whatever. But then I would actually look at like how much was their language optimism increasing over a duration of time. Because basically what you do is you throw every single thing they've ever said on Twitter into a AI model.
That looks I'm thinking about my own now and I'm like, oh boy.
But I'm always cautious to share stuff because it's like I feel a little bit creepy going through people's things. So I've been pretty like
it's public though, you know, like we all said it at some point, right?
And And then from that baseline, see like if the optimism levels are higher or lower than their average thing they put out there. And I originally did this just for myself, but then I like had some people that have been like relatively high signal in the past. One who I've talked to that I've previously even did a video on was a guy named Stack Hodler. He's a Swiss guy. A lot of people follow
Stack.
Him. Brilliant. I originally pursued that because he's a very good writer, which is why I was very interested. So there's like tons of text to go through and you can really get a sense for his mood over time. And found out that he was crazy high signal. Like he was disproportionately optimistic when price was way down and kind of pessimistic when things were up. And it was just a really useful thing. We were like, okay, this person is clearly like not just going to bull post at the top, which again, like I just want to keep framing this with like, I do this. I have done this. Like I am not like some like visionary, like that guy who understands what's going to happen in the market perfectly. I wanted to pursue this to like kind of resolve my own delusions and kind of get a better, more holistic view of like what the general vibes were out there. So people like him were really useful. I also had done like the inverse of like people that are just new to Bitcoin. Like how are they responding comparatively to these people that have been here longer, and look at the times when those have deviated over time. But you asked me about like the different chunks. I started with these individuals, but then I started realizing that I kind of found interesting different cohorts, and I've started to like ball them up together and look at them against other cohorts. So one of the best examples and most interesting things is I've taken like OGs or people that have been around much longer and then compare them to these shorter term people. It's kind of a similar thing to what happens like with the long-term holders versus short-term holders, kind of that similar idea where you could watch if there's deviations between the two cohorts. And like even as of right now, one of the interesting things is that your average like older Bitcoiner is significantly more optimistic in the language that they're using than these newer people that are just coming into the Bitcoin market, which is super interesting. These people are like disproportionately afraid. The newer ones and the OGs seem to be like weathering this. And like, we've been here before, we've kind of recognized this. And I thought that was really interesting. And again, it's kind of helped me, I feel, have a more balanced viewpoint of where things are at. Like I'm not a trader. I'm not day trading on this stuff. Right. Just like wanted to see what was here and form a more accurate worldview or Bitcoin view because of that.
Okay. There is so much stuff I want to dig into here. A slight digression, but just, you mentioned Check, James Check, and he's like, that's my quant. You know what I mean? Like he's fantastic. People should check out. He's come on the show a bunch. He's got a, you know, great newsletter. Go check out James Check, Check on Chain, if you haven't already. And because he's also very, like, he's got his Check the Analyst and Check the Hodler. And I'm curious, in terms of these different cohorts you're looking at, these different data sets that you're looking at, these different sentiments, have you tried kind of overlaying some of that onto some of the analysis that he does from the on-chain perspective, just to see, because you mentioned the kind of short-term holder, long-term holder, like you know, some of these, the OG whales versus the people who are currently, you know, in the red because they just bought 6 months ago. Have you overlaid any of that at all at this point?
I'm getting there, but I tried to emulate what he did in a different manner. Actually, this is one I haven't even put anything out with this really yet, but it was one of the most, another just thread I wanted to pull on, see if anything was there. So I took every single user I have in my system and I looked through every single tweet they'd done for instances of talking about Bitcoin price ever over time. And then I graphed every single one of those on a chart. So you can see like the levels that people talked about Bitcoin over time and how it relates to the Bitcoin price. So you can see like, when we were chopping, like that summer of 2024, I believe, like people were really like, you could really see them talking about these lower bounds. And when we were at all time highs, people started talking about like 200K and 500K and all these crazy levels. And then now people are talking about like lower things again before this. And now they're like, you just like actually see on the same kind of interface that Check looks at, the same similar visualization, like the specific price levels that people talked about. And some of them are these price levels that he's also found with like short-term holder cost bases and these kind of things, because those just naturally show up more in people's tweets when they're thinking about these numbers. So that was cool. And I also did a similar style where I looked at different cohorts and saw what price levels they were talking about over different time periods. And that was kind of interesting too.
This is all really fascinating. Do you view this also, I mean, can it be used almost predictively? Like if you had this set up to track some of these more high signal cohorts that, you know, based on historical data, tend to provide a pretty good signal one way or another. And I'm sure you have like counters. I imagine Peter Schiff's a great counter signal. We can maybe get into that a little bit later, but is there a way for this to be used predictively where you can say like, okay, I just got notifications that like the sentiment levels based on these key cohorts are hitting this, you know, this level, which means like, boy, it's like looking pretty bullish or it's looking pretty bearish. Like, have you got into that side at all? Or are you still just kind of doing a lot of scraping right now, kind of a lot of the historical analyses to set that baseline?
Like I mentioned earlier, I've had a bunch of people from hedge funds and that kind of world reach out to me and be like, this is literally how they're trying to do those things. And it was kind of a different, interesting take on it, especially in the Bitcoin space is very different than some of the like individualized stocks they were looking at in their domain. But this is exactly how they're trying to do some of those things. So, and I've kind of, looking back, realized there definitely have been like inflection points where people like the OGs, for example, were much more optimistic than the newer people. And those have actually proven out to be pretty historically. It's like, you never know how these, well, these things, and if these models keep working in the future, but they've been relatively predictive of like times when things looked pretty good, or it was a very opportunistic time to buy Bitcoin, these kinds of things. So looking back in the past, there definitely does seem like there's some signal there to some degree. Like I said, though, this is relatively early for me. I'm only a couple, few months into doing this, and I really wanted to use it as a way to better understand things myself. So I haven't been trying to do any of that kind of stuff, but I am working with some other people now that have started to reach out and want to explore using these things. Adrian Morris from True North has been doing a lot of work in sentiment that's crazy interesting to me, and him and I have been talking a lot about this recently, where he wrote this brilliant essay about like how sentiment has been such a unique thing in the Bitcoin space. Like one of the dynamics of Bitcoin, like every market is very heavily impacted by sentiment. But Bitcoin, because it doesn't have these like metrics that people in the traditional finance world have traditionally traded on, like PDE ratios or like cash flows and these things, it's a lot more sentiment based. So I think like Bitcoiners in general are a little more familiar with how much sentiment impacts things. And then a derivative of that would be like the MNAVs of treasury companies. But there's like an additional layer of sentiment on top of the Bitcoin sentiment about each of these individual treasury companies. And I've even made attempts at measuring that where you can look at like the rate these treasury companies were mentioned over time and what moods and these sorts of things. And there's definitely some interesting stuff there too. But lots there.
Wish you could access cash without selling your Bitcoin? Ledin makes that possible. And the global leader in Bitcoin-backed lending, Ledin, has introduced their lowest rates ever. No complexity, no fine print. The larger the loan, the lower the rate. These new rates apply to all new loans, refinances, and renewals. You'll see the rates up front before you apply. The new lower rates come with Ledin's gold standard protection. Your Bitcoin remains custodied and is never lent out for interest. Perfect 8-year track record of keeping clients' assets safe, auto top-up, LTV alerts, and partial repayments to keep you in control. Repay whenever you want with zero penalties or monthly payments. Ledin's perfect $10 billion plus track record through every market cycle in the last 8 years speaks for itself. Don't choose between a great rate and the safety of your Bitcoin. Get both at Ledin. Check out your rate by using their loan calculator at ledin.io/walker. That's ledin.io/walker. If you're hodling Bitcoin personally or for a business, here's the uncomfortable truth. You probably don't have insurance. Most policies exclude Bitcoin, and the ones that don't, they only pay you back in fiat. What's the point of that if you need to claim a loss when number go up? That's not insurance, that's liquidation. Now there's another option, BDIC. They're building an insurance marketplace on the Bitcoin standard. One Bitcoin lost equals one Bitcoin paid. They've integrated with Liana Business for enterprise self-custody, with personal wallet coverage options coming later this year. If you care about protecting your Bitcoin as Bitcoin, sign up for the waitlist at bdic.io/walker. That's bdic.io/walker. Insurance on the Bitcoin standard. Blockstream Jade Plus delivers robust security with fully open source hardware and software. Its unique genuine check feature ensures your device is authentic, giving you ultimate peace of mind. With versatile connectivity options, including Bluetooth, USB-C, built-in camera, and SD card, Jade Plus offers unparalleled flexibility in managing your Bitcoin. Whether you prefer wireless convenience or air-gapped security, Jade has you covered. Its innovative design features a durable metal case, a bright 1.9-inch color screen, and intuitive navigation buttons that make managing your Bitcoin straightforward and enjoyable. Jade Plus also supports secure, air-gapped transactions via QR code signing using the Jade Link storage device, keeping your Bitcoin safe without compromising convenience. Visit store.blockstream.com and use my coupon code WALKER for an exclusive 10% discount on your Blockstream Jade Plus. Protect your Bitcoin, sleep better, stack harder.
This is also fascinating. I mean, you know, I don't mean to throw a million things like, hey, have you done this? Have you done this? Like, I realize this is also like a side project, you know, hobby. Like you have, you're a dad and you have a job and hopefully just got a little bit more free time because you're not writing the book anymore. Yeah. And we could talk about that too, but it is amazing. And I assume you're using, a number of AI tools to help with this analysis to put this together?
Oh, absolutely. I mentioned the AI models specifically to run the tweets through, but sure. I'm an engineer of 13 years. I've just loved to make and build things my whole life. This is the kind of thing I would have always wanted to build in the past, but would have been something where it's like, I would need multiple years and like a dedicated team to do these sorts of things. And because of my experience, I was really quickly able to like architect this whole thing, throw it together and do some of the UI layers and like the visualization stuff and like some of the other just like challenges of this really, really quickly compared to what I previously could. And it's such a dynamic thing too, where I'll like get an idea and then I'll want to visualize the idea quickly. And so it takes a lot of like changing of things or building new stuff. But because of how much I'm able to leverage these tools, it's allowed me to iterate really, really quickly, get to a new idea, test it out, see if there's anything worth pursuing more there, and then keep following that thread as it like kind of shows itself to me that it might be interesting. So those have been profound. At the conference, I was like my panel was basically about AI because I've been like a crazy power user of these tools. Even when writing the book, I was too, but they've really changed the way that I think about building things completely. And it's been really, really powerful in this. And like, I'm quite the optimist when it comes to AI in general.
I do want to get into that as well. I want to poke at a couple more things on the sentiment side first. In terms of like, you mentioned Stackhodler is a very high signal. What are some other, I guess, very high signal accounts that you're looking at where that you've decided? I assume you've run analyses on Sailor, maybe Lynn Alden, people like that. Can you give some of those in terms of the ones that you're really looking at where you're saying, these provide me with really good signal? And then what's the Peter Schiff cohort as well? Let's talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, so yeah, you mentioned a couple names in there. Lynn's crazy high signal and proved out to be in some of the data too. No surprises there, I don't think, for anybody. Maybe one that's less talked about was Andy Edstrom. He ended up being incredibly high signal and he's very optimistic in his post right now. That was one thing I just kind of discovered as of this weekend, honestly. Sailor is, some of these are interesting because there's like different lessons that can be gleaned from different people. Like people like Sailor are speaking in a totally different manner to people like you or I, where he knows his tweets are like analyzed out there and he's being very careful with the things he's saying sometimes. I think that's part of the reason he uses some of the AI generation for the stuff that he does too. So that one is, I think there's interesting stuff there in a different way where it might like show different moods happening under the surface that he's not saying. Like that was kind of interesting when it comes to him, but he's not like this crazy high signal person in the sense where he's like really much more optimistic at bottoms, more pessimistic at tops. Another one is Joe Carlisari. I have huge respect for Joe. He just finished his book too. Him and I have talked
about that.
Yeah. I have a huge amount of respect and learnings from him, frankly, because he's like, when I first came to Bitcoin, I think what most people do, you're like a little bit overly optimistic about where things are going and you're more euphoric. Joe is very calm and middle of the road. And I always just really respect that. It's been, it's powerful to help have a more realistic worldview. So he ended up being one of those people that was really high signal as well. And kind of related to this, I know I haven't even answered your Peter Schiff question yet, but like maybe one of the most interesting findings was something I called like sentiment volatility. Where I've noticed this across every single Bitcoin user I've ever looked at now, where when you first kind of come to Bitcoin and start posting on here, your like average volatility of like your ups and downs and your mood across every different mood is wild. And then over time, those people tend to be more muted. And that's part of the reason why like some of the OGs and stuff I think are a really good signal here because they've kind of been around the Bitcoin ecosystem longer and they are a little bit less taken by whatever new narrative is wrapped up the average pleb out there. So I've seen that in my own data too, like looking at what I was doing early on compared to now, I'm a little bit more like realistic about things. And yeah, that was super interesting. I think probably follows what people naturally think too. Like intuitively, that made sense for me. And then Peter Schiff, like that was, I don't want to like call any people out necessarily as like anti signals, but Peter Schiff is a very obvious one. And because of that, I wanted to analyze his stuff too. Couple hilarious findings with him. He is absolutely posting in a more annoyed kind of way and using more angry language when Bitcoin runs up. And I have data on him from a very long time doing this because he's been doing this repeatedly for like since a long time, but since 2020, like crazy. And that was just comical. The other thing with him is that when I started looking at the rate at which he was talking about different things, like people view Peter as like a gold account. Like he's the gold guy. He actually has tweeted the word Bitcoin more than the word gold more times since 2020. So he is arguably more of a Bitcoin account at this point in time by his overall language and usage than he is a gold account. Since 2020, it flipped. Like he was always talking about gold pre-COVID. And then afterwards, he's been talking about Bitcoin more often than gold, which I just found absolutely hysterical. And then the last thing with him is that like if you were to buy Bitcoin whenever he tweets about Bitcoin, you perform insanely well. I think you did some cool stuff on that too, if I remember correctly.
Mine was probably far less involved than yours was, but I did just like a baseline analysis of this. And yeah, it was basically like if you bought a dollar of Bitcoin or a dollar of gold every time Peter tweeted the word Bitcoin, like your Bitcoin return, I'm forgetting the exact data, but like it was like an order of magnitude greater returns. Like it was a massive amount if, you know, and that was when gold had like been running up too and Bitcoin was down, and it was still like an order of magnitude greater returns denominated in fiat, of course, Federal Reserve notes. But I think that's fascinating. Well, can I ask you then, what is the Schiff counter signal, anti-signal saying right now then?
Pretty good, honestly. Most markers are honestly pretty good right now, at least in the sentiment stuff. I haven't been like very predictive about it. I've been
right
very cautious. Like this is sort of new to me, and I don't really want to be prescribing much stuff. But seriously, like across the board, things are looking pretty darn good. The most recent one that was kind of a good counter signal, perhaps. I've been trying to mostly look at Bitcoiners because, they're talking more about Bitcoin and they have a really strong signal if they're hyper-focused on Bitcoin generally. But out of curiosity, I wanted to ingest some crypto trader folks and see what they were at right now. And I had like one of the most ridiculous things yet that stuck out to me around them, where it's a smaller cohort of these people, but their average use of like disappointed language, which is like one of there's a handful I use. This has been one of the better ones. Is like absolutely going parabolic right now. Like the average crypto trader out there has never been more disappointed than they are right now, in a wild degree, like one of the highest outliers that I've ever seen for this, at least in the sentiment stuff. I did a small post about it yesterday, but that's kind of a good counter signal as well. And again, like I mentioned, these like the OGs, this other cohort that I found that's very high signal generally are much more optimistic than the average person right now. Those are all trending aggressively more optimistic currently. Yeah, I can keep going on the other ones, but I think I kind of answered that question.
It's super interesting on the quote crypto side of things too, and that just mirrors that just mirrors anecdotal, like non-quantitative, just qualitative observation from my side for basically this whole kind of bear market. There's this general vibe, I think, that the crypto thing is kind of like people are realizing it's like, oh shit, the ship is really sinking this time. Yeah, we can print other ships out of thin air, but they just sink immediately too. Like the jig is up a little bit. And I think you've also seen that mirrored in the actions of the large crypto exchanges. You've seen Gemini, Coinbase, Robinhood. Like we can call Robinhood basically, they have the same gamification. Like, I mean, they basically invented a lot of that gamification. Hmm. The same vibes there, but they all at like about the same time rolled out prediction markets to their users. And then, you know, Gemini and Coinbase are like rolling out stock trading as well. So they're all becoming, I think it was Alex Leishman of Rivers, so like they're all just becoming one app. Like it's all just the same app, right? And most of it, I mean, like 80 to 90% of the volume, not volatility, but the volume on prediction markets is just sports betting, which is like, fine, do whatever you want with your money. But like, let's just be honest about what it is. And so I think it's really interesting that you've seen this sort of quiet pivot by the big crypto casinos to say, it's basically an implicitly saying, look, we're done with like the, you know, the tokenized gambling. We're just going to do real gambling now. Like just, okay, call it what it is. But they're kind of like lessening up on the crypto side of things, focusing more. Coinbase has had to focus on stable coins, obviously, for a while. Yield generation, but then also just the prediction markets, where it's like, I think it's kind of the realization that, okay, people just came into the crypto side of things for the gambling. Let's just cut out the middleman and give them the gambling. Like, we don't need to slap some DeFi sticker on it and pretend that we're doing something innovative. Like, let's just give them gambling and like we'll make more money. But I find that that vibe has been, I mean, if you have been holding Ethereum instead of Bitcoin this whole time, or holding any crypto besides Bitcoin, like, you're not doing very well at all. And if you were trying to trade every shitcoin under the sun, like, you probably got wrecked. But I don't know, maybe those people just pivot to prediction markets too. Maybe they come around to Bitcoin, Michael. I don't know. But like, you, boy, it is tough with some of those people.
You're kind of reminding me, I totally forgot to mention this, but one of the interesting group that I looked at was crypto exchange CEOs. So I literally bundled all of them together, basically the ones that you just rattled off there, and looked at the language they'd use compared to other Bitcoiners. Because at the time, one of the really prevalent narratives was STRC, continues to be. And I wanted to see if like these guys were talking about that at all. And almost every group of Bitcoiners I've looked at across the board has talked about STRC to some level, even or not. What was so interesting is like these guys are not talking about MSTR or STRC a single time. Like, I didn't have a single instance of them ever talking about this thing. And I just thought that was interesting because it's like a really big narrative out there, regardless of what you think of it. It's like a very defining thing out there in the ecosystem. And these people, I think like I'm going to like put words in their mouth a little bit here. Like, there's no data behind this to prove it, but like, to me, it seems like they recognize that the Sailor strategy is clearly a better strategy than what they've been embarking on. And it's kind of like that same saltiness thing that gets out there. Like, well, you don't talk about the thing that's like outperforming you or doing well. And like, they're like, to your point, like their actions of getting into gambling and just BS it speaks volumes to where they're at right now. And they're clearly, I think, have a little bit of animosity towards Sailor right now.
I think that that's a very interesting point there. And it makes sense too, right? Because they've spent all of this time trying to, you know, basically put lipstick on a crypto pig, right? And it turns out like everybody can still kind of tell, like, yep, okay, that's a pig, like a disease ridden pig. Nobody was going to eat that pig. You've tokenized that pig's, I don't know, something. I'm going to stop with that now before it gets gross.
I was enjoying it, man.
Yeah. But the point being, it's like, Sailor has kind of come in here, and you know, I know a lot of Bitcoiners too do not love what Sailor is doing. Hmm. I think he's a huge net positive for Bitcoin with all the stuff he's doing. I think anybody, like, it'd be very difficult to make the case that he's in any way a net negative. Like, you can argue that you don't like what he's doing, but he's free to do it, and I think it's ultimately positive. That's my personal opinion, you know, not financial advice or whatever. Okay. But these guys, it's like they've tried to just create this, you know, incredibly complex Rube Goldberg machine of, you know, trying to extract value from people. And it's honestly, I think it's like, it's just like shocking to them perhaps that, look, we could have been creating value for people like Sailor is doing, or like Alex Leishman for, you know, take out the stock side of things. Leishman and River, not a sponsor of this show, just very happy user. They're giving you 3.3% paid in Bitcoin on any cash that's sitting in there. They could keep that like your bank does, but they're giving it to you. They're creating like Bitcoin products in that financial ecosystem that are actually valuable to you as a customer. Whereas every single crypto exchange has just been finding new ways to list new shitcoins to basically fleece investors at the expense of at retail. They're pumping their own bags or pumping their friends' bags. And it's just like, it's so extractive. And now it's pivoting to the Strike gambling. It makes sense. Like that tracks. But it's like, you could have just been trying to do things that are actually beneficial to your end customer. Like, instead of wrecking your end customer. And that's something I talked with Alex Leishman about. He's like, look, like our philosophy is like, we want our customers to be happy and get value. It's crazy, I know. And like, we want them to not become dissatisfied. because they've been wrecked so many times. Like, we don't want them to get wrecked. We want them to keep being our customers. And so it's like, but boy, I think it'd be pretty difficult for any of those big, you know, crypto casinos to do a full Bitcoin only pivot at this point. Like, just especially like there's no way Coinbase is doing that. There's no chance. They can't. They're publicly traded. There's no, like, I'm sure investors wouldn't like that. You know, they're going to lose a bunch on fees. There's just no way. So their hands are tied a little bit. I'm not excusing them by any means. I'm just saying, like, there's no way they're ever going to pivot there. Like, they just maybe should have kept it to Bitcoin in the first place.
To me, like, one of the most beautiful aspects of Bitcoin is the alignment of incentives, where we can play these games together and create value and all get lifted up. Like, that is absolutely what places like River are doing. And that's the opposite of what places like Coinbase are doing. They're directly extracting value in aggregate from their users. Like, this is a short-term strategy. And what's crazy to me is, like, if you understand Bitcoin, you kind of like understand that inevitably, like, those kind of strategies probably aren't going to work over a long enough time horizon, but they still chose to do them. It's such a trip, like, that happened, that they chose to spend their time in that manner by directly leeching the wealth out of the exact people who they claim to have as customers.
It really is just honestly, like, shocking. It just seems incredible. It's like a very fiat mindset, right? It's very short term. It's very high time preference. It's very extractive. It's very fiat, I would say. I got to ask you too, and then we can, maybe we'll circle back into this prediction stuff, but I do want to get into some other topics with you. But I have to ask, have you run the analysis on me by any chance?
Yeah, I did. Yeah.
Oh boy. Do I want to know if I'm a good signal or not?
So you and I actually have a similar dynamic in the sense where, like,
I'll take that.
My data is not always great, because when I launched my book, I had so many people reaching out to me being like, dude, this is amazing. I loved it. So I'm like, my tweets completely flipped when the book launched, where I had so many replies to people being like, I'm so grateful for this thing. Like, thank you so much for all the positivity. So, like, my level of, like, usefulness on that data is not particularly high.
It's skewed after that a little bit. Okay.
Whereas, like, before that, I was a great anti-signal. Like, and a lot of the times, like, I definitely bull posted at tops and whatnot. I definitely did say some smart things, but, like, on average, it probably was not the best signal. You recently, with everything that happened with Carla, it was like, you had, like, this crazy high levels of, like, gratitude and positivity. And it is, like, interesting seeing that, because, like, this data is not always perfect. You can't just be like, all right, well, this optimism thing is going to perfectly track the Bitcoin price. Like, we're all humans. There's a really human element to this, and which makes it very unique and kind of interesting too, and creative, because it's like, it's not like this perfect, like, data-driven thing. There's like a human element behind it, which you need to be cautious about who you choose and listen to and whatnot. But I just thought that was interesting. Like, I looked at your stuff, I was like, oh, wow. Like, the kind of things you've been talking about have really changed since that.
It is super interesting. It makes me think too that this is really could be, you know, not just as a tool for Bitcoin sentiment analysis, but just sentiment analysis in general, like, to almost check yourself a little bit, like, to see, like, you know, your own, you know, mood swings over time and how much gratitude you are practicing. Like, I think this has super interesting implications kind of more broadly, just as like a tool for self-reflection. Is that kind of, has that happened for you at all through this process of exploration?
Seriously. Yeah. It was kind of interesting looking at that, like, and then seeing times where I definitely knew I was kind of depressed in this time period, and then seeing I had, like, lower levels, and it literally came out in the language and the way I was relating to people. Like, we kind of know we do that, but to actually visualize the data and the things you said, and then I have it set up where I can, like, go back and look at my tweets in that time period, be like, damn, man, like, you maybe should practice a little more, like, kindness when stuff is down. Like, I remember vividly getting into arguments with people that were totally unnecessary when Bitcoin price was down, because I was kind of aggravated and I was spending time on Twitter about it, or during, like, big conflicts, which is an interesting dynamic too, because, like, around some of these events, people disproportionately are angry, that kind of thing. And that shows up in the data too. There's all sorts of interesting things there, but I, like, honestly, you could just run these tools over the things you say out there and kind of get, feedback on, like, the, like, if how kind you're being to other people, which is an interesting thing. Like, a maybe more depressing one is, like, the people that have had, like, people die or, like, negative things happen to them, that also shows up in here, which is always a little bit heartbreaking too. It's a weird thing, because it's like this marriage between, like, this really analytical data side of things and, like, this really human and emotional side of things, which is why it makes me so curious, but it's also just a strange thing.
Maybe one other question, because questions just keep popping up because this is fascinating. Have you thought about running this on, like, what if you applied this sentiment analysis that you're doing to, for instance, like Fed press conferences? Mm-hmm. Like analyze and use, like, you throw that together and are able to use it in some sort of a predictive way. Like, then that becomes, I think, an even more interesting product to a lot of people. But have you thought about doing that? Like, have you looked at some different types of data sets just to sort of check the assumptions, even about the assumptions you're making within the Bitcoin data sets? Have you thought about looking at any other sort of, you know, macro, let's say, elements of to analyze for sentiment or geopolitical even? Hell, I mean, like, you could throw this at anything, right?
I know people have done that for, like, Trump and Jay Powell, like, to actually look at things and see if there's stuff there. Some of the hedge fund dudes, like, they've mentioned that kind of thing is happening behind the scenes. It's just usually not public, which is interesting. Mm-hmm. Like, again, I didn't really know this existed that well because it's not out there, but apparently it is out there. It's just these things are happening behind the scenes and they're not sharing it with you because it's a way that people find alpha. They're like really old, like, a lot of this is done through the lens of, like, political people or, like, famous folks, like a sailor. I guarantee you, like, he's aware that this thing's happening with the things that he says because he's head of such a big publicly traded company that has a lot of volume on it and these sorts of things. You can definitely do some interesting things with this. Like, you can even, like, look at different world events and see how different cohorts of people reacted to that, like narratives that popped up around it, narratives that change over time. So, like, for example, Saylor was the first to say, like, digital credit pretty much. And then you can watch that narrative spread across Bitcoiners, proliferate through the entire system and see which channels it's going through, which is really fascinating too. To answer your original question a little more directly though, there's some reasons I gravitated and kind of had this idea around the Bitcoin space. Well, because I'm a Bitcoiner, obviously. Like, that was the main thing. It was just like the water I swim in, I wanted to, like, understand better. But the Bitcoiners talk about Bitcoin to a crazy degree. It makes up a huge part of our lives. And, like, the entire reason I used Twitter in the first place was to talk to Bitcoiners and make friends in the Bitcoin system, which makes our moods a little bit better representations of where things are happening compared to somebody who's just, like, buying some Walmart stock or whatever. Hmm. Like, there's a lot of people that invest in little companies that aren't as directly impacted by the Bitcoin price. It's very, like, instrumental to those of us in here, which makes it much higher signal. There's also some things with different data sources. I did look at ingesting podcast data, and that's possible because you can get transcripts relatively easily from videos and see how stuff is trended. But what's interesting about Twitter data specifically is that it's much more frequent and over longer time horizons. So, like, a podcast, like Saylor, again, because he's a pretty good example of this because he does tons of them, will go on a podcast one day and then maybe 2 weeks pass and he goes on another one. And then maybe they were filmed at the same day. I don't know. Maybe they were filmed farther apart. There's just a lot more, like, messiness in here where if you look at tweets over time, people are tweeting almost every day. So you get, like, better accurate representations of how people, like, their underlying mood is changing over time. So those kind of things are arguably better done on Twitter data sets. Podcasts, however, are oftentimes where, like, narratives will start or somebody will say a really interesting idea for the first time. I'm very interested in language. I like the, like, study of etymology and, like, how languages change and evolve over time. And these things are just fascinating to me. I am curious if you've noticed, as, like, somebody very much in the Bitcoin podcast realm of, like, I will see somebody mention something on a bigger Bitcoin podcast, and then that phrase will proliferate to all sorts of other podcasts. Like, it happens with Saylor all the time, but I've even seen it happen with what Bitcoin did before, where, like, some new guest is on there, they say dollar milkshake theory, and then suddenly every Bitcoiner says dollar milkshake theory and every bit of analysis they do subsequently. I always just noticed that and, like, found it interesting, and now I'm literally, like, analyzing how that happens in Twitter data, but it happens a lot in podcasts too.
It definitely does. I think that's a good way of describing in terms of podcasts being more of, like, a narrative setting function versus a tool for actual, you know, vibe checking for sentiment analysis, right? Just because, again, like you said, like, you don't know when it was recorded, you don't know, like, that there's gonna be so many confounding variables in there that would throw that off. But there, I've definitely noticed that as well, and I think that one of the reasons that happens too, dollar milkshake obviously is something that's, you know, it's a good example, but it's one that's been around, you know, for a long time, but maybe people hadn't heard about that before until that. And then they start looking into it and it's like, but there's also, I think, especially with Saylor, I think, especially during his kind of early run of podcasts, cause he's done so I don't know how many, between Saylor and Lynn Alden, just the pure breadth of podcast appearances is incredible. But you would see him actively kind of coming up with things in real time, like, because it was part of his journey, I think, was going on and talking about these things. So you'd see him actually, like, creating new analogies, thinking up on the spot with new ways of saying things, new ways of phrasing them. And I think that was, I think you get less of that now because now he's got it, let's say, quote, figured out more. And from to your point earlier as well, like Saylor is a great PR guy. He knows that he needs to be very, very, very careful about what he says, anywhere publicly. And so it's a little bit not scripted or anything like that, but he's got a tighter vernacular, let's say, versus when he was in more of his just like, going galaxy brain phase with all of this. And there's just all these crazy analogies coming out. They were like, really, really good and really helpful for a ton of people. But it's fascinating. I was just thinking about this and really like what, because you mentioned the spreading of different ideas, like the digital credit, for example. Saylor's kind of, he's a patient zero for that. And then it spreads. It's really like what you're able to analyze through this, which I think is fascinating, is essentially mimetic propagation.
Yeah. Right?
You're able to see how memes spread in a very real and kind of analytical way. And I think that's fascinating. You could probably do some really neat data viz work on the mimetic propagation specifically. But I find all this fascinating. I could keep asking you questions about this all day.
That's the one more thing before
go for it. Yeah.
I've already started to do some of the things you're describing here. One, but two, I'm like obsessed with language. I think language is crazy. And I think people underestimate how powerful it is as a tool. I know you have to have this experience doing podcasts where like the language is more than just like a thing you communicate with. Like being forced to form thoughts out of your brain and make mouth sounds with those thoughts is like a profound thing that forces you to actually crystallize your own ideas too, like you were describing with Saylor. One of the reasons I fell in love with writing is because of this dynamic where I had all these ideas, but they're kind of messy in your head. And then writing them down and refining is really powerful. Like there's something crazy with language interrelating to humans. LLMs being another example of this, where like the way we found AI to work is by like leveraging the power of human language and like aggregating it and pushing it out in interesting ways. Like, I don't know what the takeaway here is. I just think it's crazy interesting and that like language is still an underexplored thing, which was one of the drivers for my interest here.
No, absolutely. And obviously you must love language because you wrote, you've written two books. Now let's talk about Blood of the Bourgeoisie a little bit. Again, if you have not read it yet, if you like to read, go order it. You can find it on Amazon. If you like to listen to the audiobook, I've got my copies around here. My studio is very messy right now. It is somewhere right around here underneath a bunch of sound panels that I have not yet installed. Go order it. Go listen to the audiobook if you want that. You can hear me do multiple different female voices as well, which was a very, very fun experience for me, honestly. I was like a little bit daunting at first. But you created some really great characters in this. Can we maybe back up a little bit? And why did you decide to write Blood of the Bourgeoisie in the first place? What was the catalyst for you saying, I'm going to write a Bitcoin thriller, but it's not just going to be about Bitcoin, but it is going to be about Bitcoin. How did you decide? Like, what was the I need to do this moment?
So I've been writing for a while. I originally just started writing and did journaling for quite a long time and had some ideas I wanted to explore deeper. And I had some takeaways that I wanted to share with people. My first book was about like the importance of embracing your genetic differences, like neurological diversity and these kind of things, and what that might look like in a world where people are wanting to eliminate diversity among people, like in neurological issues and get rid of like autism, ADHD, like Tourette syndrome, etc. That was a whole thing. A lot of learning processes, but I learned about Bitcoin on the journey of writing that book. And as soon as that one wrapped up, I was like, I've developed this skill of writing and a love of writing. And I felt like I just owed something to Bitcoin. I think a lot of people feel this, like you. I'm a fundamentally different person for having discovered Bitcoin. I'm way more optimistic, I'm constructive, motivated, just like so many different things. And I felt overwhelmingly like called to do something for Bitcoin, right? Like a lot of people do that. I think that's a pretty normal thing. Like, hey, you're doing a Bitcoin podcast. Like I imagine you have similar sentiments around that, right? So I just started writing and I wasn't sure where it would take me. Again, I like to pull on threads. Part of the reason I fell in love with novel writing is not because I like had a perfect vision for a story. It's like, I know something in my heart like wants to do this and we're going to see where it goes. So that's all I really started with is I wanted something around Bitcoin. And the longer I spent just like throwing tons and tons of time and proof of work at it, like the thing kind of naturally evolves, which I think is one of the more beautiful things about artistic creativity, is you get to just like kind of see where an idea takes you. And it turned into something really cool that was very different than what I was originally envisioning, but it kind of turned into this thing that I wished I could give to people. Like, I have tried orange peeling many of people, which I'm sure that you have too. And it doesn't typically go that well. I've given, like, got my bookshelf over here, like the Bitcoin Standard or like Lynn's book. Like, I've directly given those books to people. They not gave a single shit about the book and ignored it completely. I was like, man, this sucks, because this, like, these things changed my life and were really positive. So I wanted something that like I could package up in a way where I could give this somebody with literally no interest in Bitcoin that like might read a thriller and see if they could have some like sly roundabout exposure to Bitcoin in the process. So that's kind of what it turned into, where it's written in a thriller format, very captivating, which was tactical in the sense where like different chapters and switching character POVs and like really making sure like it's very quick read and fun read. Like having that, but having Bitcoin laced into it, particularly in a way where like it's not throwing technical concepts at you from like page one. You don't even like see the word Bitcoin until like maybe four chapters in. And then it slowly, incrementally levels up to the point where like the way things resolve in the story and the stuff is fundamentally related to how Bitcoin works and what Bitcoin is. So yeah, it's kind of high level overview of it at least.
I love the book. It is very dynamic. The chapters, there's 69 chapters total. I believe, nice. I remember when I first saw that, I was like, was this on purpose? You're like, you know, maybe, yeah. But they're quick, right? They're snappy. They're keeping you on the edge of your seat. It's an intense book. Also, like, it is, as the title implies, like there is blood. And it deals with some really, I think, some of the concepts that it deals with outside of just strictly Bitcoin, right? Because it's a Bitcoin thriller, but it's not just a Bitcoin thriller. Like a lot of what you know, and without, you know, giving away any spoilers, and I think this is fair to say, a lot of what you get into in the book is really about sort of the class struggle, but then also about, let's say, the American hegemon more broadly. What, you know, our military actions or lack thereof in different places, the marriage of various, you know, political and corporate interests. Like it digs into a lot of different things. And it also digs into, I think, very largely the theme of anger and resentment towards the current state of things, but approached from different perspectives, mm-hmm. with very different methods of, mm-hmm. let's say, alleviating that frustration. How much of it did you want to be let me ask this differently. Was your goal in the writing to provide a commentary on some of these things, or just to write a good story? Because I feel like so much now, whether it be the written word, whether it be visual media, whatever it is, so much, let's say, ideology is injected into so many things, often at the expense of the story itself. I don't think that you did that. I think that you just wrote a great story and these things work together naturally, but I'd love to understand kind of your process, because I'm sure you were thinking about that. I'm sure you were trying to grapple with those things as you were creating this story.
Yeah, you were spot on there. That story was first and foremost, literally at every time. Like every time there was a major decision point in the story or went in writing the story, it was like, okay, everything that always matters is story first. It has to have a great story that matters more than anything else. Great story, captivating, top of mind every single minute of writing that thing. Some of those things kind of came out subconsciously through me. Like these are things that I'm struggling with and thinking through, and they came out naturally in the book. The theme of violence is high in there as well. I train in like firearms and other stuff like that. I'm very interested in like these concepts of like what it means to like defend oneself and like when you should use violence and that kind of thing. And that was definitely a theme. But in the sense of like Bitcoin, it's like I feel so much like I have two people inside me, right? Like I have, represented by a couple different characters in the book, I have so much anger towards the way the system currently works and want that to change, like the Eric Kaysen style, like I just want to hang the political class and all these things. Like I have a part of myself that feels that way too, but I also have a part of myself that's like much more pragmatic about the way the world works and how Bitcoin can have a more positive view and a more sly roundabout view perhaps. And I see that in a lot of Bitcoiners too. So it was like, I really wanted to explore that. And I didn't go into it thinking like it's going to, the story is going to interweave in this specific way, which the story eventually kind of comes together, right? I didn't have a super concrete plan for that right away. I just knew I wanted to explore these concepts and kind of see where it took me. Which writing is a weird trip. It's kind of like a self-reflective process. You kind of like learn about yourself along the way. You sort of like don't know where it's going to take you. I wrote the last chapters of that when like Bitcoin price was at like under 20K. And the very first iteration of it, like it was terrible, but I kind of like found parts of it in different times. And I was sort of different people back then too. Like you're kind of a different person every day. And like you go over the book and edit it through a lens of like the different parts of you. And through enough work and just like sitting down and doing lots and lots of stuff, it comes like lots of parts of yourself come out through the story. And I definitely think I had a lot of that formed those things. It's maybe not as clear of an answer as you were hoping for, but like that's
no.
Like writing is very much like it's a scatterbrain thing, at least the way that I do it. And there's a lot of different ideas that end up getting melded together just because that's who I am. And that just like, well, that's what I wanted to see in a story.
No, I loved it. And I think that was very clear as I was reading. And then obviously, you know, talking to you about it extensively in the process of recording the audiobook, just to make sure that I was, you know, I was going to understand the characters and the motivations well enough and everything. It was very clear though, even just the first time reading it, that I was seeing again, without trying to give too much away, you know, a couple of the characters in there very much were representing sort of two sides of your own experience, two different, or perhaps the same ultimate urge, but two very different ways of expressing that urge of trying to bring about the future, the reality that you want, into very, very different sides of the spectrum in terms of how that's approached. And I think that, again, to your point, that is something that as Bitcoiners, I know I personally, I saw my own kind of, you know, mental struggle in that thing that we all go through where it's like, you want to, and I'm speaking in hypothetical terms here for anything, for any of the censors out there who may want to flag this. Please don't remove this. This is too good a conversation to rip off. But that's why we're doing it on Nostr. And thank you to everybody who has zapped this already in the live stream on Nostr. Appreciate you all very much. But that struggle of, I want to fucking burn this thing down. And what rises from the ashes, we will be so much better and more glorious and more fair and more true and more honest. And then also like, boy, if we burn this motherfucker down, a lot of people get hurt along the way. And I also don't want that to happen. That's not that there must be a different path. There must be a middle path. There must be the path of absolute complete peace. We need to, you know, just metaphorically burn this thing down. And you know, utilize the incredible open source technology, the freedom tech that we have, whether it be Bitcoin or whether it be, you know, Nostr, whether it be different forms of encrypted communication, we need to use those tools, and that will help us usher in this future, but in a very peaceful way. But it's like those two ideas so often necessarily come into conflict with each other and with reality, right? There's the world or as we would like it to go on, and then there's, you know, there's what actually happens, right? And so I think that was just that was a really impactful part of the book, was seeing both you as the author, seeing you come through, and then realize, yep, I'm seeing a mirror into myself as well. I'm seeing my own experience. I've had these same sorts of conversations, you know, with myself or, you know, with Carla, with other Bitcoiners. Like, it is a very, very relatable experience, and the way that you presented it was through the mindsets of multiple characters, which I thought was a brilliant way to do it. You didn't try to wrap it all up into one person having a struggle. No, it was actually the struggle of the characters with themselves, but also with each other. And I thought that was from a literary perspective, I thought that was very, very effective.
Thank you very much, first and foremost. That was definitely a big challenge of it too, to not be too prescriptive and tell people how to think and just like help the characters guide you, right? One of the things that was tricky in writing this was like, I did want to write this for the average person who had no interest in Bitcoin, but like you spend like, I literally spent thousands of hours writing this thing. Like it was a ton of my life that I threw into this. I couldn't not have like these deep existential Bitcoin conflicts that like were in my own head come through. So like there's like a layer that's like right there for anybody. That's just like, it's just a good thriller that you'll read it. Like maybe you don't like the Bitcoin thing, but it's like still going to be good regardless. But if you're a Bitcoiner, there's like a really, really deep level that's running through the whole thing about this constant struggle about like how revolutionary? Should we be about this thing? And how do we think about that? Some of the trickier parts to sell in the book too are kind of like, really, like, I don't want to like give too many things away about this, but like the best parts of it are things that I don't want to spoil about it that Bitcoiners are going to adore probably.
That's, I mean, a really difficult line to tread, right? Because I know that your goal was to make something that, again, would be approachable to people more so than a nonfiction Bitcoin book. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, like, so you don't want to put too much Bitcoin stuff in there to, quote, scare them away. But at the same time, you also want to apply to or appeal to a core audience of Bitcoiners who you know are going to read the book and are going to really love and relish those parts that are about Bitcoin. Was that a pretty difficult balancing act, I imagine? Just like that must have, I imagine, been a near impossible task.
Hugely so. I'm like, it's been relatively successful with that in mind. I've gotten people that have, like, were a Bitcoiner, loved it, then immediately gave it to like their mom or like their family member, that sort of thing. And they're like, one of my favorite ones, just like their mom read it in like 32 hours or something like that, just like cruised through it completely. And it was asking them all these follow-up questions about like how self-custody works and these things, because that's kind of central to how things play out. So like, I know this works. I literally just had a friend from jiu-jitsu world reach out to me yesterday being like, dude, I just finished your book. Like, that was amazing and insane. Like, he's not like really into the whole Bitcoin thing yet, but he's like kind of curious now because of it. And that's been really interesting too. So I know this has been relatively successful in some small way, but you can't not be a Bitcoiner and like want to make something great for Bitcoiners. Like, it was just like an impossible thing to not do to some degree. It was just in the same way it was impossible for me to not bring out some of the things that I've been actively thinking about so much relating to Bitcoin in the book. It just kind of comes out through you when you're in the mode of artistic creation.
Can I read a couple of quotes from the book that are not plot related, but I just think are really good lines, if you're okay with it? Like, there are no spoilers here, but just there's one. These are ones that I jotted down as I was going through and recording the audiobook, and I just, like, they were ones that really jumped out at me. So I'll read a couple for folks, and hopefully it piques someone's interest out there, because these were ones that when I was reading them, I was like, damn, that's a banger of a line. So. Starting out, from Harold's vantage point, the financial system probably seemed fine. Why question a machine designed to serve you? Most rich CEOs never bothered to understand Bitcoin because it didn't affect them. I think that's just a really like a simple statement, but it's actually what we see playing out here right now. The next one here, the wealth of generations was embedded in her brain. I thought that's a very poetic way of talking about self-custody right there. Investors lined up to hand them free money during capital raises. Politicians, on the other hand, couldn't fathom why the people they governed would turn to Bitcoin. When you can't, when you control the money printer, you can't imagine a world without it. Alan was just like, chef's kiss. Let's see. The duty of a true patriot is to protect his country from its government. That one, I was like, fuck yeah. Damn right. The American spirit wasn't born of bureaucracy. It was forged in rebellion. Again, just beautiful. Liberty is wasted if it's not used to make hard choices. Again, those are a few in a row where I was just like, man, those are very profound statements and ones that kind of like you get the goosebump moment when you're reading and you're like, goddamn right. Like that yes. I got a couple more here. No spoilers again, I promise. Let's see. This one is just frustrating, but also just very true. The average person doesn't care if the financial system is designed to make them poor. Even when presented with a way to escape from the system, they'll come up with every excuse not to learn about it. That one was just like the way you put that, because that's the frustrating thing, I think, for so many Bitcoiners, right? Is we feel like we're shouting it from the mountaintop. We want people to know. Maybe we're not always the best at delivering that message, right? But there's a lot of us delivering it in different ways, and that message does get out there. And yet, this escape hatch exists. This lifeboat exists. But people really, that way you phrase that, they'll come up with every excuse not to use it, was just like, yes. But why? Is it because people just, the part of it is just like, almost being obsessed with one's own suffering, or not wanting to accept that there could be a way out, just because this is, you know, this is the water you've been swimming in. You just, you just don't know any better. I don't know, but I'd love to hear your thoughts on that. Cause that one, I was just like, yep, that is the experience of basically every Bitcoiner trying to talk to people about why Bitcoin is important and they should, you know, adopt it. But
That one hurts a little bit. Cause it's like, in writing the book, like the goal is to convey this concept to people. Right. But like at the same time, I know it's not going to be successful in every way. Cause like we've all failed to do so many times. But yeah. There's a lot there. And like the one, thank you so much. Those were amazing hearing you read them once more. This perspective. A couple of them I cannot take credit for, though. It was other characters quoting famous American.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But still important, like important parts that were like, oh yeah, that's, I'm glad you included that, you know?
Yeah. But it's a hard thing. Like the amount of concern that's out there around Bitcoin from people like when I say Bitcoin, like there's so much embedded in the word Bitcoin for me. Like it's hard to not see the world when you understand Bitcoin to this degree. It's like I'm blanking on the word for it right now, but like there's a kind of like bias that one has once you've been doing something a long time. Man, doesn't matter. It's just impossible to convey all the things that you know about Bitcoin to other people. So like having different perspectives, like one of the reasons I did that in the story was just to like try different angles. But I think like a framing that I've been thinking about a lot more recently is that sometimes it's just about taking shots on goal. Like I got exposed to Bitcoin a few different times from different people and totally ignored it, as many people do, I think, when they come to Bitcoin initially. Yep. We pretty much all do this. And that can be heartbreaking if you have somebody you love that you're trying to convey these concepts to. I've given my book to people who probably still haven't read it because they're like family members or close people that I just like wanted to make sure I put this in front of them. And it hurts when it's not going to work to actually orange pill them. But I think a more constructive way to think about it is be like, all right, well, it took me a bunch of exposures. It's going to probably take other people a bunch of exposures too. Like just because I threw something out there, put a book in front of them or mentioned Bitcoin to them, like, and they just totally shrugged it off. Just because it failed in that single instance and in that moment doesn't mean it was a failure, because you could be that second touch point and they needed 5 or they needed 6 touch points. And there was still something worth doing in providing those touch points, even if it wasn't the thing that ultimately orange pilled them in that moment. It still is part of their journey potentially. And I think to get like more comfortable with that, where you're not gonna like go in front of somebody and immediately orange pill them. Like despite my desire to, like I'm not just gonna be able to give my book to people and immediately like they're gonna be a Bitcoin maxi overnight. Like maybe have a little bit of success with a couple, but like overall it probably ain't gonna happen. But I think it's a more constructive mindset to have, to be like, all right, well, at least I'm making positive movement towards this thing and helping in some really, really, really small way to spread this really great message.
I like that framing a lot. And that's absolutely the way I've kind of come around to thinking of it too, because I myself, as you were describing that, I'm thinking about my own journey. You know, I've ignored Bitcoin. I'm still to this day, the time I spent ignoring Bitcoin, as in I heard about Bitcoin and then from first hearing about it multiple times since then, and then finally getting some sats, that time is greater than the time I've been holding Bitcoin. Mm-hmm. I heard about Bitcoin in 2014, but buddy was, you know, acquiring some things off the Silk Road, asked me, you know, Walker, have you heard about this Bitcoin? You're an engineer. Have you heard about this like Bitcoin thing? You know, whatever. I'm like, no, I haven't, you know, nerd, like back to whatever fiat shit I was doing. You know, dismissed it, you know, again in 2017, and got a couple of Litecoin because I didn't realize you could buy fractions of a Bitcoin. So I always have empathy for people who are operating from that perspective, you know, less excuses to think that way now with all the education that's out there, but still I have empathy. But it wasn't until 2020, right? So it took me multiple instances of exposure, of hearing about this thing, of ignoring it, essentially dismissing it, whatever, before I finally went down the rabbit hole just a little bit, just peeked into it, and then got some sats. And that's the start of it all, right? It's like you know, getting off zero, that's the hardest part. Once you do that, a lot of the rest of it follows, because you just naturally get more curious about this. You come for the number go up, then you find out about the freedom go up side of it, and it's like, holy shit, okay, this is something I didn't even realize existed. A whole new world just opened up to me that I wasn't privy to before. But I think that mentality that you described from an, quote, orange pilling perspective, it's like the term orange pill, like it is a good term, and it has a lot of mimetic power. That being said, it's almost a little bit like you can't give anyone, you can give some the orange pill, you can't make them take it, right? that step, it has to be somebody willingly taking it. Like, you know, I know there's the Max Kaiser joke too, and you know, I love Max, but like the orange pill now or the orange suppository later, like, and which is hilarious. But really, you have to make the decision to study Bitcoin yourself. You have to make the decision to take the orange pill yourself. Nobody can take it for you. You can't force anyone to take it, but you can just, hey, here's this Bitcoin thing again, present it in a different way. And you never know which one of those interactions that somebody has is going to be the one that finally flips that switch and gets them to get off zero and to start learning about this thing. And so that's why I think these different angles, I don't want to say angles of attack, angles of enlightenment, let's say, enlightenment vectors for Bitcoin are so important. And I'm curious too, if, I mean, one, do you think you'll write more Bitcoin fiction? And then two, do you think there just needs to be more Bitcoin fiction or Bitcoin tangential fiction broadly?
One, yes. I really like writing. I'd like to do another one. Yeah. This is a very long process though, especially the way that I write.
Same universe, you think? Or yes. Would you? Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. I've got rough plans for it too, but it's a very like arduous thing, man. Like I really love people. And like writing, just like sitting alone over the chair in the corner of my office over there for like literal thousands of hours is quite the undertaking. It's AI tools have changed the way that writing works quite a lot. I mentioned I leveraged and even writing the book, but even with that, like it's more about like how much love and a piece of your like soul you put into the words. Like if there's a way you can leverage that, like anybody can produce like AI slop these days, but to like really, the thing that makes people connect with stories is like deep levels of care for them. So it's a very long-term process. Anyway, I would like to write another one. That's definitely going to happen at some point in time. Just might not be very quick. I have a little shelf over there behind me, actually. I don't know if you can see, but there's a bunch of Bitcoin fiction books on there, like different levels of indie authors that have written different things in that realm. So it's out there, but man, like there is... It's crazy still. Like I see people having things like there's like a comedy coming out that's like something like Satoshi related or whatever. It's going to be terrible probably because it's mainstream. Like there's so much of this out there, and it's so like if you just bring up the word Bitcoin to people in any kind of fictional realm, like most of these people are not interested. I've also noticed like something I did not realize when I was writing and I maybe was overly optimistic about was like the average fiction reader has a very different perspective of the world than the average Bitcoin person. I figured this out the hard way when writing my first book too, where I got a little bit canceled because of some of my like optimism around neurological diversity. But a lot of people use fiction as an escape tool. They're not wanting to challenge beliefs. They're not wanting to be told that like technology actually is like this abundant creating thing for humanity. So there's some very challenging things to put in front of fiction readers and have them just devour. Like if you can like persuade them and say the book was really good or whatever, like it's one way to get them. But in general, the market for fiction is so overpowered by like romance fantasy stuff that people are just hoping to use to escape into magical worlds and these kind of things, where it's a different tool and it's great for conveying things. And like me being more engineering brained, like I've had a bad habit in the past of trying to convey really technical concepts like Bitcoin in logical ways to people. So doing it from a more emotional angle is oftentimes more successful. And I think books are a really good way to do that. But the cohort that is reading books are very much less likely to be optimistic around technology or interested in like things like Bitcoin, unfortunately. So it's still a really good tool, but it's kind of tricky to get them to read it over their like dragon smut books.
I've seen like a couple of memes about this that I had to like actually check if like the book existed. Like there is just so much weird fantasy smut out there. I mean, maybe that's you know, your next book, just churn it out, just real sloppy, real smutty, you know, a little who's writing Bitcoin smut? That's the real question.
Megs has got plans apparently.
Okay, oh boy, here we go. That is interesting though, but it's also interesting because I mean, I'm somebody who I've loved fantasy and science fiction generally for a long time. I took kind of a break from it, actually, from reading it when I got into Bitcoin, when I started going down the rabbit hole, just because I felt like anything that I would be reading that was fiction would somehow be like a waste. I literally thought like this will somehow be a waste of my time because like I should be reading more Austrian economics. I should be reading more I should be reading more, you know, philosophical texts. I should, you know, I'll read anything but fiction. And you kind of get burned out on some of that after like a little while without like a little bit of fiction. And it was Devin Erickson's book, Theft of Fire. It sort of reignited that love for, well, in this case, you know, hard sci-fi, but just fiction more broadly. And Lynn Alden's given some really great recommendations on other more fantasy side things and sci-fi, but like, you know, The Mistborn, Brandon Sanderson, awesome. If you haven't read Mistborn, it's a killer trilogy. Go check it out. And also the Stormlight Archive. And just recently I'm doing the audio, listening to the audiobook right now for, I just finished Hyperion and now I'm on The Fall of Hyperion, which I don't know if you've done it, Dan Simmons. It's a really good, good audiobooks. Also just a fascinating story written in 89. And the way he talks about AI and the multi-planetary future and all these things are like super, it's super wild when you read that. Like, or like Snow Crash is another great one. I hadn't done Snow Crash before. That's a solid audiobook as well. That's like, for those that don't know, like that's where the metaverse comes from. I'm also pretty sure that's where Balaji's network state theory basically comes from, because he's just basically describing a more utopic version of Snow Crash. But anyway, my point being in all of this, there's like, science fiction generally makes me really optimistic. And fiction more broadly, I think good fiction should actually, like, it's a great teacher. It's a great teacher. It's a great vehicle for self-reflection as well. And it's interesting to me that the experience that you see with a lot of, let's say, the average fiction reader is that they're not looking at things in this optimistic way, that they're not looking, you know, that it's all, you know, doom and gloom, essentially. And I'm just kind of, you know, maybe that's just also, I don't know if it's what they're reading or if it's they're searching for things because of their own state, they're searching for things that will reinforce that state. Does that make sense? Like what comes first? You know what I mean?
Yeah, a couple things there. One of the most interesting dynamics of fiction, in my opinion, is like the ability to write around in another person's head. Like,
yes,
that doesn't really exist in any other format. I'm a huge podcast consumer, but even if I'm listening to podcasts, it's like not in my own head. If you're literally reading fiction, you are, as you read the character's thoughts, they're like going through your mind. And something about that makes you think like that person. And fiction does that in a really creative way because you're like literally in their thoughts. So like it lets you like really play with ideas in a way that it's almost impossible to play with other domains, which is one of the reasons it attracted me to that in the first place. Second thing there was, I'm a huge Brandon Sanderson fan as well. Mistborn is one of my all-time favorite books. That all of his stuff's good, but Mistborn was like the magic system in that was like one of the best ever magic systems.
Super
not,
cool.
Not best ever. It's literally the coolest magic system ever created in fiction. If you haven't read that yet, really cool. Especially if you have more of like a problem-solving brain and you're not a big fiction person, that might be one of the best ones because the way he does magic is hyper-logical and you get to see how he thinks through stuff. It's just brilliant. I've not read Hyperion. That's on my list now for sure. What was the third question?
I guess generally like what comes first in terms of the do people seek out things that just reinforce their own mental state and mood for the most part when it comes from a fiction reader or fiction listener perspective, or do you think a lot of it is just driven by the type of content that is the contemporary content that is out there? Like, should, you know, because again, I read science fiction, like, and it like makes me hopeful and interested about the future and gets me thinking about all the, even if they're talking about dark things that are happening in a potential future, it's like just the act of talking about it, it opens you up to so many possibilities. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, for sure. I think it's like a multivariate thing where like there's a really bad industrial complex around fiction in general. Couple of things there, like maybe take it a slightly derailment, but like, I used to ask friends questions about the world, like what percentage of people do you think are this thing or this thing? And like, see what they said, because a lot of the narratives that come out of Hollywood are disproportionately making you think the entire world thinks and believes that thing, because the vast majority of our fiction is produced in Hollywood. And Hollywood is not representative of me. It's not representative of the average person in the world. If you live anywhere else, it's not Hollywood. And I think like that is a really toxic thing, where this really small group of relatively extremist people are like exporting their belief system on the rest of the world. Really resent that that's the way it works right now. And I wish there'd be a little bit better free market of ideas in creating the stories. Like like right now, oftentimes the best story does not rise to the top and then become the thing that gets made into a movie. Instead, places like Netflix will do a bunch of market research and figure out what things they're going to like get money for, and they'll make another Christmas movie. My wife loves them. They're good. Like they maybe warm your heart a little bit, but they're not the kind of story that I crave. Like I like really like these like deep ones that make me think in different ways. And like, I feel like I've changed a little bit as a person having read them. Like that's what I want more of. And it's out there. Like there's amazing books that have been written, but a lot of the way the market is currently structured around fiction is very fiat. It's really a toxic thing. Like I don't totally write off the people that read smut either. Like I think like there are really great stories out there, as much as I like poke fun at them and criticize them. And like these other like more escapist styles of fiction writing, like even Brandon Sanderson, who I mentioned and I really love, like a lot of people like to read that to go into a fiction world and like not have to deal with the problems of their day to day. And I don't think there's necessarily anything wrong with that. It's just kind of a different preferences with reading. I feel like it's kind of if that's all you do, it might be a little bit of a fiat thing, but I know people directly that exclusively read these like fantasy books as a way to escape problems in their own life. And I think that's a really big problem. So I think it's kind of like both of those things acting at one time on the same person, where like, the market caters to it because people want it. It's downstream of how badly the average person's maybe doing. But there's still amazing books out there at the same time. It's like one of these whole, like, the future's here. It's just not evenly distributed dynamics where, like, both of these things exist. There's amazing books out there that people just, like, don't read as much as they maybe should or like, or like, kind of unknown relative to how amazing they are. Like, it's kind of sad, but it's just the world we live in.
Yeah, no, it's a fair point. We can just throw out some recommendations here, because another great, first of all, Blood of the Bourgeoisie, go check it out. But even just recommended you, have you done the Dungeon Crawler Carl series?
You are one of many people that's recommended that to me. So that's high on the list too.
Lynn recommended it to me. And I was like, what, Dungeon Crawler Carl? Like, okay, what is this? But it's fantastic. And like, as somebody who's narrated some audiobooks now, the narrator for it is like the greatest audiobook narrator I've ever heard. Like, he's incredible on so many different levels, like to a level lesser men cannot even fathom. Really great though, that's a big series. What else are you reading anything right now in the fiction space? Do you have any current books open, any books on the shelf waiting to be read? What are you reading right now?
I'm really eclectic in my reading preferences. Okay. And I'm in a weird place right now because I read like crazy. So I read a bunch of different genres too in writing Blood of the Bourgeoisie. I wanted to have like I literally was reading romance elements because there's like human relationships in that book. And it was my worst thing on like early passes is I had like weak relationship building. So I wanted to read a bunch of stories in that realm just so I understood that, how to write that better. All over the place. Some of my favorites and ones that I've read recently are like Blake Crouch. I have a shelf over here with a bunch of his books on me. He's a sci-fi and thriller author that I really love. Yeah, I actually do have Fourth Wing open right now too, which is one of those dragon smut books that my wife was like, you have to read this one.
Wow.
And it's pretty good. She was right so far. Okay. I haven't gotten any of the smut parts yet, so I can't speak to that. But the actual story in that writing is really, really good. I also have, I think I mentioned at the very beginning, I'm very all over the place. Like I'm reading like 7 books at a time, and I'll like hop around different genres and things, which is kind of weird. And I don't know that I would recommend that to anybody unless your brain works that way. But I got lots of random things open right now across genres and that sort of stuff.
Nice. I'm gonna have to check out Blake Crouch. So he did Dark Matter. Is that the one they made into a show?
Yeah. Show's okay. Book's fantastic.
I saw the first season of the show. That's why I was asking. I'm interested to check out the book then. That's
High concept sci-fi that moves like a thriller pace. Like if you couldn't tell what the bourgeoisie, I really like that like thriller dynamics for attention reasons. Like we have in a crazy short attention span world right now. I think like shorter attention span fiction is underexplored, and there's a lot of it out there, but like I think like those sorts of things in writing are really powerful, and I want more of them in like more philosophical genres, I suppose is a way to put it.
Yeah.
Like, I want really deep topics for books to explore, but packaged in a way that just makes me cruise through it, and that's kind of hard to find actually.
Yeah, no, that's fair. I wouldn't be conscious of your time here because we're butting up against it. People should go and get Blood of the Bourgeoisie. You'll learn how to spell it in the process of searching for it by Michael Sullivan.
check, get the physical book, get the audiobook, check it out. I really think I can guarantee Bitcoiners will like it. Like if you're listening to this and you're a Bitcoiner and maybe you haven't picked up a fiction book in a while, like go check it out. Give it a try. Like it's a smooth read. You will like it is a page turner as well. The character development is great. There's a lot of good Bitcoin info in there too, like the way you present it. So I really encourage people to go check that out. Give it a shot, especially if you've just been like me, you were stuck in a Austrian economics, you know, rabbit hole for too long and you emerged, you know, not remembering what fiction was like. Go give this a try. You have my ringing endorsement. You had it before I narrated the audiobook as well, but now you've got my double endorsement on that. Anywhere else you want to send people to, direct people to, anything else you're working on that you want to bring attention to, let me know.
Yeah, let me just say before that like Walker's narration of this thing was just like top tier. He absolutely killed it and it's fantastic. There's a reason I reached out to him too. Like his alignment with some of the Bitcoin ethos that's in the book, like just could not have been better. I, again, don't want to spoil stuff. Like there's very much like American central theme that's part of the book too, that like, yeah, he was my first and basically only choice for narration. So if you like Walker,
appreciate that,
podcast, you're gonna like the book and especially the audiobook. As for where to send people, the best place is usually on X. I'm Sully Michaelvin, like my name, Michael Sullivan, but inverted. I also have a couple links on there to like the book and all the sentiment analysis stuff I've been doing recently, which I'm just exploring. Feel free to shoot me DMs if you have any other things you want to see around that. I'm on Substack too, but yeah, any of those normal places you can find me. And then the book's available where books normally are. It's relatively easy to find. As you can spell the weird word.
Yeah. It is tough to spell. Michael, appreciate this so much. Anything else you want to leave folks with? Anything else before we close out?
Stay bullish, y'all.
There we go. The sentiment supports it. And we've just added another podcast-based sentiment data point to this while also steering the memetic propagation narrative. So you're gonna hear memetic propagation out there now on the interwebs after this podcast episode, I think. But man, appreciate you. Appreciate your time. Go check out Blood of the Bourgeoisie, everyone. Thank you to everybody who joined on Nostr. This show live streams on Nostr. So if you're not on Nostr, you won't see the live stream. So go on Nostr. And thank you for the zaps, everyone. Michael, great chatting with you, man. Good catching up. Hope we can do it. Hope we can do it in person at some point soon.
I love that.
And that's a wrap on this Bitcoin Talk episode of the Bitcoin Podcast. Remember to subscribe to this podcast wherever you're watching or listening, and share it with your friends, family, and strangers on the internet. Find me on Nostr at primal.net/walker and this podcast at primal.net/titcoin. On X, YouTube, and Rumble, just search at Walker America. And find this podcast on X and Instagram at Titcoin Podcast. Head to the show notes to grab sponsor links. Head to substack.com/@WalkerAmerica to get episodes emailed to you. And head to bitcoinpodcast.net for everything else. Bitcoin is scarce, but podcasts are abundant. So thank you for spending your scarce time listening to the Bitcoin Podcast. Until next time, stay free.